The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly, the podcast that takes the technology bull by the horns and holds on as it stampedes into the future. I'm Alex Kratosky, and joining me in the steeplechase are our gaggle of regulars, Jemima Kish, Charles Arthur, and Guardian podcast favorite, Bobby Johnson. Bobby, how many podcasts are you actually involved with at the Guardian?
Just the two, basically, and then sometimes News Desk.
And you get media. Sorry,
Guardian Daily.
You're a pod.
All of them. Apart from sport.
Pod-tart.
Well, last week, innovators from around the world descended upon Geneva for the 36th Annual International Exhibition of Inventions. And what a wild bunch of new toys were presented to 65,000 attendees. The grand prize went to Mr. Jiang Su Li, who invented an electricity monitor for household appliances, which is all very good, very Guardian. That's fine. But other top inventions included a French fashion line's clothing made from bamboo, a bed that makes itself an artificial nose hair. I kid you not. Anyway, what would you like to see next year at this crazy invention, Willy Wonka style?
I want cloning so that I can do as much work as I want to. Is that really sad?
A fusion reactor for laptops, because a fusion reactor for laptops because the battery on my laptop has just died. It just refuses to wake up now.
Why don't you plug it in?
Well, because then it's not. What's the point? Got a portable computer that I always keep plugged in. That's why you need the fusion reactor. Okay.
I want an elevator to the stars. Oh, a space elevator.
Is it Richard Branson working on that?
Yeah. Oh no, just one that keeps the moon pinned in the same position. That'd do me.
So a people mover from here to there.
Yeah.
So anyway, back to reality. And this week's show promises to thrill you. Bobby demands answers from Xbox's Neil Thompson. We look at the good that technology can do with an exclusive report from last week's Social Innovation Camp. We dive further into the forum scandal with Cambridge University's Dr. Richard Clayton, and we discuss the rest of the news, what you've been saying in the blogs, and more. So take a deep breath, grab those bullhorns, and join us for the ride of your life. It's time for Tech Weekly. The Xbox 360 games console was the first of its generation past the post, but not without its growing pains. Although the live network system has been hailed as a resounding success, the machine has been dogged by technological problems since its release, has thrown up a challenging price point, which 2 years later is only just becoming affordable, and gaming innovations have been few and far between. Bobby, you dragged Xbox marketing director Neil Thompson out for a cup of tea last week and demanded answers. What happened?
Oh, it's a really interesting conversation, I think. Neil, who is essentially the head of Xbox for the UK, Ireland, and a couple of Scandinavian countries, went out with me for a chat, and I thought, okay, let's ask him some questions. We all know what's going on with Xbox. We'd like to get some answers. You know, what about the Red Ring of Death? What about all the problems that it's had in various ways? What about the price? You know, people get very upset about that. And I threw out an open call on the games blog to the readers to, you know, ask some questions that I could put to him, which is always very useful. And so, you know, we got him in a corner, pinned him down for a bit, and peppered him with questions. And I started off by asking a bit about the Blu-ray and HD DVD battle, which obviously Microsoft has now basically been on the losing side of. So my first question was, Neil, what's it like to back the wrong horse?
The future for entertainment content such as movies, etc., is basically online digital distribution. That's the horse we're backing. Ultimately, people are going to move to an online digital distribution of that sort of entertainment content. So I think, you know, if we're sitting here in 12, 18 months' time, we'll be saying, you know, why were people even thinking that a disc format was important when it's really about digital distribution, and do you have the best platform for digital distribution or not? I think a lot of people who move very quickly with brand new technology accept there is an element of risk of how that technology is going to evolve. But I would argue that because we didn't build it into our core technology offering from the start, that was absolutely with customers at the forefront of mind, and we didn't want to handcuff people into a disc-based technology that they would be paying a premium for, that in the future they'd kind of say to themselves, why did I pay that premium? And I think the fact that Sony are desperately trying to deliver an online service, et cetera, means I think they probably understand that there's another front that they have to go and develop for.
A lot of people constantly contact me, and there were some comments in the open questions saying that they really felt that they were paying through the nose being a British consumer. Do you think you're being entirely fair to UK consumers in your pricing?
Yes.
And why?
The reality is, doing business in Europe and definitely in the UK is a more expensive business because of economies of scales and other economic factors that do impact. And I think most people generally understand that we tend not to make a lot of money on consoles. The way the business model works is the money's made on the other services such as software, etc. So, you know, in a lot of ways, I'm constantly trying to get the price of our consoles as low as I possibly can without being dumb from a commercial point of view, and that's what we've done recently. You know, for people to think that we're artificially trying to keep them high goes counterintuitive to the way this business works. So make a simple analogy. In the US, if Walmart decides to buy a few million consoles, we will generically send that to one, maybe two distribution centers in the US, and then Walmart ship it out in their massive trucks with everything else that they ship. If we decide to do a similar thing in Europe, we'd have to send that to tens of distribution centers, if not sometimes hundreds, because of the way different markets and different retail operators operate. If you then start to compare, well, what are, you know, retail rental prices like in the US on their massive land areas where everyone drives out of town to the big shopping malls versus, you know, what a game or a game station or a Dixon's have to pay in a high street in the UK, it's just a factor difference. And when you then multiply that across Europe with all the different countries and their retail prices, it's complex.
One of the Xbox's strengths was that it went early, it was early to market,
yep,
and it focused on a reliable hardcore gamer market, you know, delivered, you know, Halo and,
yep,
and stuff like that to them. The other consoles have come to the market, and we're increasingly seeing a lot of people talking about, you know, the success of the Wii, games like SingStar and Guitar Hero and Rock Band, and the kind of this new casual market that's opened up. To the ordinary guy in the street, or gamer in the street, if they perceive things about the landmark titles on those platforms, then, you know, all of Microsoft's landmark titles are hardcore games where you spend a lot of time blowing people up.
Well, I just disagree with that assertion. I agree that some people think that. I disagree that most people think that. And I disagree with the people that think that, with the assertion that all we have is first-person shooters, etc. We have some iconic first-person shooters on the platform. I absolutely agree with that. But if you look at what we've done with Konami, with Pro Evolution Soccer, you look at what we've done with EA, with FIFA, and the broadening games that they have, there's a whole stream of content that I could argue plays to that broader audience. The reality is, that's just not true.
The big subject.
The big subject.
The big subject that everybody was asking questions about. Yep. The dreaded red ring of death. Can you just explain what went wrong?
There is a certain percentage, which isn't a massive percentage, but there's a certain percentage of consoles that were experiencing disk failures or CPU failures, whatever word we want to use, which was higher than we wanted, hence why we brought out the 3-year warranty.
You said the CPU then and disk failures. Over the course of the problems, we've heard so many explanations. Are we talking about a single point of failure or different points of failure on lots of different machines?
We're talking about some common elements that we found that needed fixing. In terms of the reliability, as I say, I'm not the right guy to ask for precisely what those are, and I'm not sure we'd, because it's somewhat of a complex process that you have to go to figure out, well, what's the sequence of things that happened in certain cases. But we've rectified that, and we're now into a position where we think the reliability is pretty standard for what the electronics industry would expect.
Have you ever suffered from the red ring of death?
Yes.
And what? How did that feel?
Disappointing.
Does that give you an insight into, yeah, being a customer? That...
Yeah, I purposefully, when I went through exactly the same process as our consumers would go through. And I didn't go through the service center as the guy that runs Xbox in the UK. I just went through it as a customer, purposefully to understand how the system worked. There were some things in that process that worked for me and some things that didn't. Broadly, it was great, but the things that didn't, I fed back. And there were some things around collecting the box and when they said they were going to arrive and they didn't arrive, and could we get more precise on some of those things. Small things like on the operational side. I've gone through the process probably now about 8 or 10 times, not because I've had problems with my Xbox 8 or 10 times, but just to keep fresh and see, are we constantly improving the way we do it? And I spend time with the people that that sit in the support teams to listen into what customers are doing. And I think since I went through it, to the experience people are having now, we've got much, much, much better at it.
Thank you very much, Bobby. And thanks as well, of course, to Neil. Bobby, you were so far away in that. Where were you? Were you on the other side of the planet?
It was just, it was a very awkward situation.
Oh,
but anyway,
we got him.
Lots of bouncers between you and him. Was that why?
No, my arms are quite long. I could probably reach anyway if I wanted to give him a slap.
And did you want to?
Well, it was, I mean, as you could hear, it was an incredibly evasive interview, I think. You know, okay, the guy's a salesman by trade. He's, you know, he's in charge of sales of Xbox. He's not in charge of developing it. But he is the head of Xbox in the UK. And I think that the people who have been affected by Red Ring of Death or the other technical problems, they deserve proper answers from a person who's accountable to them in their market. They did a good job in getting to market quickly. They're paying the price for some of that later on down the line. I think they're still slightly reticent to admit that maybe there's a problem, an endemic problem perhaps.
Well, they have done a good job of pulling ahead of the other consoles. I mean, until the Nintendo Wii came out.
Well, yeah,
until the Nintendo Wii came out, then it was the Xbox really leading the pack there. So, I mean, in terms of moving forward...
Well, that's because they were out first, though, and then the Wii came along second and has now overtaken them.
I mean, Live has been incredibly successful for Xbox, but, you know, as we said when we were talking to him, if it goes down at the crucial point when people are, you know, people buy a console for Christmas and they can't get online, then that's got to be a real problem. There is an interesting thing, I think, about the perception of Microsoft in all of this, is that there's a generation of people coming through. You know, if you talk to kids who are 12, 13, 14, their first impression of Microsoft is actually from Xbox. It's not from software or whatever. You know, Microsoft, Windows and Office are just given. They don't even really realize they're Microsoft, but they do connect Xbox with Microsoft.
As you mentioned before, they have the various things like Guitar Hero and that type of thing, but they're not really pushing the boundaries in terms of games. And do you see that? Do you think that that's going to be forthcoming?
Even if they argue, as they did, that Xbox Live is full of loads of kind of casual arcade games and stuff like that, you're not marketing it in the right way. You're not, you know, it, to everybody, Xbox is still Halo.
Thank you very much, Bobby. And you can contribute more to the debate on the Games blog at blogs.guardian.co.uk/games. Now, if no one here has a Red Ring of Death to report, it's time for the news.
In a robust exchange of letters this week, Microsoft has threatened a proxy takeover of Yahoo if it does not accept its bid within 3 weeks. Chief Executive Steve Ballmer accused Yahoo's board of not meaningfully engaging in talks, while Yahoo says the threat of an aggressive takeover of the Yahoo board was counterproductive, but did not rule out a deal at an increased price. The form saga drags on. Cambridge security specialist Dr. Richard Clayton said in a paper that the service is an illegal intercept of users' data because it breaches the Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act, and we'll have more on that shortly. The UK's biggest internet libel damages to date were paid out by the mastermind of dadsplace.co.uk last week. Social housing firm Gentoo will receive £100,000 in compensation after enduring, quote, a malicious, unpleasant and relentless 2-year campaign of libel and harassment. Britain's ISPs saw their data cost per user triple in the first month of the BBC's iPlayer. For once, it's the legal content rather than the illegal content that's causing the problem.
Thanks, Jemima. And here to discuss the continuing form saga is Dr. Richard Clayton. Thank you very much for joining us on the line. So, Dr. Clayton, what was it that you were shown which allowed you to draw your conclusions?
Well, what happened was that we were invited along to form headquarters just by Liberty's in Oxford Street. where we got given a 2.5-hour presentation, which I've then written up and put on my web pages to explain how the system works.
And your conclusion out of it, which you blogged at the lightbluetouchpaper.org blog, is you said, overall, I learned nothing about the form system that caused me to change my view, that the system performs illegal interception as defined by Section 1 of the Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act 2000. Why do you think that it's illegal interception?
The way that interception is defined in UK law is that if you snoop on somebody's conversation, then in order to do this legally, you either need a warrant from the Home Secretary because you're snooping on criminals, or alternatively, you need the permission of both ends of the conversation. Now, in this case, form will have the permission of the people who are making web requests because they will have agreed to the terms and conditions of their ISP, which will say, we can snoop on all of your web accesses.
That's the average user, you mean, is the person making requests?
Yes, oh. They've given their permission. They may not understand the meaning of giving that permission, but strictly they have. Where there is not permission is for the web pages which are coming back to the user, which are being snooped on by a third party. Now, the Home Office offered an opinion on this and said, well, these web pages are all out in the public domain, and therefore, surely you can infer that there is permission. But we don't think that that's true of all web pages. It may be that material which is hidden on URLs which you only give to your friends, material which is hidden behind password systems and so forth, is not publicly available, and therefore we don't think the form have permission to snoop on those web pages without breaking the UK law.
You say that they're mixing up data protection and privacy. Which of the two do you think that they're doing the wrong thing by?
Privacy, because their system doesn't store your name and address. That much is absolutely true. So they don't actually break data protection law, but what they don't do is they don't preserve your privacy. So they discover all about you. They discover what you're interested in, and they serve up ads based on that information about you. And I think that that infringes your privacy.
So why is it then that you think that this is an infringement of privacy, but, for example, Gmail, you don't think infringes Ripper?
Well, Gmail is sitting out in California, and therefore it's a bit more tricky for UK legislation to cover it. These systems are going to be owned and operated by people who are running systems in the UK.
So if Gmail was sitting in the UK, you think that it might have issues with Ripper?
I think they'd have to concentrate quite carefully on exactly what they were doing and to the extent in which they were parsing incoming email.
And as to the phishing system, they've been sort of trying to sell it on the idea that everyone will get phishing protection if they opt, if they go with the service. But you're saying that from your examination or from the description that they've given to you, they could provide the phishing service without having to do all the targeted advertising stuff.
Yes, indeed. I'm sure they could. It's essentially a bolt-on, in my view. It's been put there in order to help sell the system.
You also note that well-known browsers are the only ones that they're going to be notified. I mean, did you get any clues as to what well-known browsers are the ones that they'll be targeting and which not-so-well-known browsers one might use if you want to avoid being tracked by this system?
They've concentrated on only handling traffic from browsers which they understand what will happen. So, for example, if you're using Internet Explorer or Firefox, then they will intercept your traffic and snoop on it. Interestingly, if you use Safari, they won't snoop on the traffic. That's not so much because
cheer, I think, went up from all the Apple users in the audience.
The reason for that, as far as I can see, is not so much that they can't snoop on the traffic, but that in practice Safari has some built-in settings, which means that the cookies which they rely on at the end of the process to serve you up targeted ads will not be sent by Safari because Safari considers that a privacy risk and doesn't send the cookies.
Gracious me. One last question, Richard. BT has admitted that it did two separate trials on about 18,000 people in each trial of this technology. We've heard that the Information Commissioner's Office is going to investigate this, but in your opinion, would those trials have broken Ripper?
Absolutely, clearly, because you can't even argue that they got permission from the person who was sending the requests. So essentially, they've been snooping on the on this data. Now, of course, VT doubtless will say, but we never actually looked at this data, which seems a very odd sort of a trial if you didn't actually look at what happened. But people have gone out on the net and found evidence of information which has leaked from these trials, which seem to have been done with an older form of the technology, which was, frankly, rather less good. And that seems to me extremely wicked of VT. Whether or not they're actually going to go to jail for it, one leaves to the courts, but it's clearly not the sort of behaviour we expect of major public institutions or private institutions.
I should point out that we did invite BT to come along and explain its position on trials, but they declined.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Clayton, and we hope to have you and perhaps BT on in the future.
You're welcome.
Now, Jemima, you mentioned the Yahoo Microsoft thing. It seems to be going on a really long time.
Yes.
What's going on there?
Everyone was beginning to get really bored of it all, Microsoft decides that this has gone on long enough, frankly, and we made you a bloody good offer, and why haven't you accepted it? And in a very, I think you describe it as a robust exchange of letters, Microsoft said that Yahoo hadn't properly engaged during the negotiation process. And then said, if you don't accept our bid within 3 weeks, we're going to take over your board and then take over your company. Not that friendly.
Gosh, that is robust, isn't it?
That is fairly robust, yeah. Yahoo came back and they said, it's absolute rubbish. We've had loads of talks with you and you were in there, Steve Ballmer, chief executive of Microsoft. What's going on here? And then they said, frankly, you haven't given us enough money and we want more money and that's what our shareholders deserve. And we're still exploring lots of alternatives. We won't rule out Microsoft. Critically, they said, you know, they're open to a deal from Microsoft. They just want more money.
Wow. It is big takeover excitement and all that kind
of
stuff.
Oh, it's panto time.
It is. Look behind you. Now, Charles, quickly, just to bring you back into the fold, can you give us some of the numbers on the ISP situation?
They're having a lot of problems because the BBC's iPlayer is proving so popular. It's becoming the number one streaming product at the moment. For an ISP, they buy 155 megabit lines, and you can only buy them in multiples of 155 megabits, which sounds great. But if you have just 300 customers all at the same time watching BBC's iPlayer, that saturates your 155 megabit line.
I think there's a big argument brewing here. I mean, last week, Ashley Highfield, who's the BBC's Director of Future Media and Technology, posted something online about a broadband charter for the BBC. And in there were some implications about how things get sold to ISPs, how BT wholesale maybe has an unfair handle on the market, which is kind of strange for the BBC to be arguing about that kind of stuff.
But I sort of looked at it and I thought, okay, well, I'm now going to wait for for all the ISPs to come up with ways the BBC could make better TV programmes. Because, I mean, I didn't quite see what Ashley Highfield has to do with, you know, whether ISPs should be offering up to 8 megabands.
But that's it. I think what they're doing is positioning themselves for somewhere down the line where the ISPs and lots of other people are going to start piling in on the BBC and saying, we want a slice of the licence fee. We have to support it in an indirect way. So, you know, this idea of top slicing licence fee for other broadcasters might also stretch to other industries that kind of support the BBC.
Well, hang on a minute, there'll be no money left for Jonathan Ross.
Well,
the fact is still that ISPs do have a problem because, you know, if you have 301 people want to watch iPlayer, then you have to set up and get a new 155 megabit pipe. Andrew Ferguson, who's the editor of thinkbroadband.com, got in touch with me to point out that BT Wholesale is going to have a new wholesale-based charging model in place. It's pretty complicated, but he said that's set to upset many apple carts and may alter how some providers charge for their broadband connection. In theory, it will have the effect of a price reduction, but if providers simply use this to lower prices again, usage will have to remain where it is now. But given the way that iPlayer is going, that's probably not going to be feasible. So we may see prices staying about the same, but you'll be able to watch iPlayer.
Well, you can watch this space, and I expect that we'll have more on that in the future. But thank you all very much. Again, thank you to Dr. Clayton, and you can keep up to date with all the technology news at guardian.co.uk/technology. I love our ident. I think it's fantastic. If
Charles is voguing.
We all get down in here when the music comes on. But if geeks inherit the Earth, it might not be so bad for the world. Last weekend, more than 100 technologists gathered in central London for 2 days of write-on web development at Social Innovation Camp, an experiment in using social technology for making social change, says the website. The folks who gathered were hell-bent on making use of Web 2 for positive outcomes. So think local network things like Fix My Street or International Exchange Network FreeCycle. Bobby went along to follow the trail, or sniff it out, I suppose. But before we hear from the innovators themselves, we wanted to hear from Paul Miller, one of the organisers, and he filled us in on why he decided to start the camp.
We really decided to do it because we thought there was an opportunity to use social technologies for social ends, really, and to try and change the world using the web, I guess. And it just started as a conversation on a tube journey, actually. And we then found some sponsors to get behind the idea, and then went and asked Jeff Mulgan, who's director of the Young Foundation, hey, can we borrow your building for a weekend? And he said yes. And then we put out a call for ideas to developers or people who understand social problems. Didn't matter, really. And we thought, oh, we might get a few back. And actually, we got nearly 80.
I'm Lydia, and I'm one third of the team now called CV Lifeline. The idea I brought to the camp this weekend was around anecdotes that I keep hearing again and again of people that are very well qualified, very experienced, very skilled, basically working in jobs that are way beneath them. People that were trained as dentists that are sweeping floors because they just don't know how to position themselves in this job market. So they were our inspiration, but where we've come out sort of 30-something hours later is with a tool that we think has application much more generally, and at the heart of it is a visualization, a timeline, a lifeline, where you can bank all of your experiences onto this lifeline. It's like a repository for everything you've ever done. You can tag it according to the sector it might be relevant to, or the skills and roles and responsibilities you assume taking on whatever it was you did. And then using that tagging, you can pull that information out really easily, saves you reinventing the wheel each time, and format it for different job application formats. So CVs, covering letters, application forms. And then the second part of it, which we didn't get to build and what we'd like to do next, is bring in the sort of feedback element. So a way to match your profile with an expert mentor, maybe from industry, maybe from your alumni group, who can give you one-on-one, very bespoke feedback much more accessibly and crucially much more cheaply than it would ever cost you if you took it to a recruitment consultant.
Hi, I'm Darren from the CV Lifeline project. I turned up on Friday night with not really any idea of which project I was going to join, but I heard about Lydia's idea and got really into it. I thought it was a really good idea, and there was lots of potential directions we could take it in. We've actually produced a working prototype of the system. We got through the specification of the system really quickly and just really got into actually building it and getting it working.
We figured actually, you know, if we've got a weekend, there's only a certain amount you can do. So we picked the ideas that we knew had massive social potential and really fulfilled a social need, but that were also capable of really accelerating in the space of a weekend. So if they required like you to build a whole new institution in order for them to work, we said, no, that's not for us. We picked the ideas that were light enough to be built in a weekend. And we got a bunch of really great kind of judges together. From Yahoo Developer Network and founders of .coms, as well as people who understand social problems, and we sat around on a Friday lunchtime with some coffee and some sandwiches, and we narrowed them down to 6 ideas that we thought were real goers, and then we put those up on the site and asked people to come along.
I'm Tom. I'm basically working for the Softshare project this weekend. It's basically a project around trying to connect trusted groups of people to share things with each other, to share stuff, reduce consumption, and maybe increase a kind of feeling of community. It's been a pretty hectic weekend. We've had probably up to 15 people that sometimes work on a project, and sort of down to kind of 8 or 10. There's loads of different routes we can take it with, and we decided to sort of go down the line of this trusted groups model, and we think and we hope that we can develop it further and get it to a kind of a launch fairly soon, and then people can get online and go and play with it. We really hope that we would get something that would be live by kind of end of play Sunday, and it hasn't happened. We've kind of gone back and forward a bit on certain issues and kind of not gone around in circles as such, but we've had to kind of revisit things when we've kind of rediscovered new issues with the ways we were doing things. I guess we've developed though quite a strong direction where we're going. We're quite happy the way we're taking it, and whilst we haven't got something to kind of production, we think that we probably can fairly soon.
And then our winners, enabled by design. Hi, I'm Denise Stevens. Enabled by Design is an online network dedicated to people who identify a need to find solutions for everyday challenges, be it as a result of having a disability, an injury, or a personal identified need. I think the general problem was that any of the living aids, as they're referred to, that I was given didn't really fit in with my own interest in design. So it ended up that my home ended up looking very clinical and like a hospital, which is where the frustration came from. I don't see why sort of adaptations that you make to your life have to be sort of dated and ugly. And it's 2008. It'd be nice to sort of have a bit of a modern twist on these items. So,
well, the whole building has been a hive of activity for the whole weekend. We've had like a media lawyer come and donate his time to all of these projects and tell them, you know, what they can and can't do, advertising gurus, the whole works, and people have been really, really getting into the projects, and it's just been absolutely fantastic. To be honest, like, I'm convinced that all of the six projects are going to keep on going. So yeah, it's been a fantastic weekend. I'm exhausted, and I need to sleep for 48 hours.
I'm absolutely ecstatic that we've won the competition for the Social Innovation Camp, and I'd just like to say thank you to my team because they've been fantastic.
That was Denise Stevens, project leader of the Social Innovation Camp winner Enabled by Design. Bobby, you were there while in situ. You had the chance, obviously, to speak with quite a few people about this. And do you think that any of these projects are actually going to have legs? Do you think they'll get all the way to funding?
Well, I think it was intriguing to see the way the weekend developed. On the first day, there was clearly a lot of social worker ease going on. There was a lot of you know, talking about feelings and stuff like that.
Group hugs.
Yeah, well, it felt a bit like that. But as the weekend went on, they kind of meshed in with the developers and the coders, and they came up with some fairly good projects. I mean, I don't think any of them are world beaters at the moment, but they were clearly the seeds of some good ideas, and maybe they can go out and get funding. When it came down to picking the winners, I think it was very much about looking at people who had clearly identified a kind of a gap in the market and then had a good idea for filling the gap. They hadn't necessarily built a website that did it, but maybe they had got some of the way towards it. The most developed project actually was one that started off being called Barcode Wikipedia, which was essentially, you know, you can scan in a barcode or send a barcode from your mobile phone and you immediately get back information from a website about that product. The underlying idea was you get back ethical information, or, you know, is this fair trade, or, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, some of these guys, you know, they built fully functioning, proper websites. They didn't necessarily look brilliant, but they worked, and they worked pretty well. They did that in 2 days, which you'd normally spend weeks and weeks.
What I really like about the whole camp ethos, because there's food camps, there's bar camps, there's various camps out there, is that it is very, very task-oriented. It's task-based, and it sounds like this one was as focused. You know, you have 2 days to build a product, to build a thing.
Well, one of the main sponsors was NESTA, the National Endowment for Science, Technology and Arts, which invests in lots of companies and people in this kind of area, that, you know, broadly. And they're really interested in whether this is a model they can use for kind of thrashing out ideas. You know, rather than having to make a gamble on somebody who comes to them with a pitch and says, I need some money to take this further, get them in a room, get them working really hard for a bit. At the end of it, you get a really good idea whether it's complete shit or whether there's somewhere to go from there. And then you can hopefully put money into the right things rather than just throwing cash maybe in the wrong direction.
It is, yeah, it's very interesting. And certainly when I was at bar camp in Brighton a couple of weeks ago, I know that there were some government bods sniffing around. So to try and implement this type of thing, as you said, NESTA are interested in doing as well. So we'll certainly see more camps of this nature. I think they'll be spreading through, they'll be rippling through in the future. Thank you very much to Bobby for filing the report and for the innovators who have the drive to use their tools for good rather than evil.
Hey.
Charles is voguing again. we should start doing videos, because that would make YouTube's top 10 viral video. What do you think, Jemima?
Yeah.
Anyway, so what's been going on in the blogs this week? What do you have on your your radar there, Jemima?
God, well, you know, it's been a while since we had a blog statistics spat.
So without going into the who said what, which gets rather tedious, Guido Fawkes and Ian Dale appear to have been a little confused about the unique user number and the visits number, variously by calling them the unique visitors and then confusing that with unique visits. I can see I'm losing you already.
Is this on PDA or is this in general?
Well, this is what I summarised. This is what I summarised on PDA. But there were lines like this one from Ian Dale who said, "An absolute unique is someone who visits the blog at least once a month. A unique visitor is someone who visits the blog at least once a day. These are then amalgamated to get the monthly total."
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's my only response.
Anyway, the bottom line is that they appear to have inadvertently been inflating their figures.
No.
And then there was a big debate about, well, it's very difficult because even a unique user number, you know, somebody could have been at two different IP addresses and count as, you know. So it all got very, very long-winded, but best comment undoubtedly was King of My Castle, who said, "I think Donald Rumsfeld said it best. As we know, there are unique visitors. There are visitors we know are unique. We also know there are visits. That is to say, we know there are some visitors we know visit. But there are also unique visits. The visitors we don't know don't visit."
God, you need a PhD in something or other to follow any of that.
Rumsfeldese.
Obtuseness.
I always thought that was one of the great quotes, actually, of all time.
It does kind of make sense, the original.
If you write it down and are able to read it. Anyway, on the UK, on the games blog, yes, on the UK games blog,
that
would be, yes. Well, actually, it was Keith. Keith wrote about Street Fighter, the film. And that threw up the perennial question, why don't movies about games or based on games work? But Stops at Green started out and he says, "I think that the problem is that the storylines and scripts of most games are rubbish to begin with," which I concur. "They may have strong design and IP, but with a few notable exceptions, rarely is the story compelling, and they lack genuine emotional content. With something like Halo, I could barely begin to tell you what the story's about, but it's a lot of fun to play. So what production companies buy is a concept and some characters, but no story to tell." And Imperfect Rex sort of touches on another component of why these don't translate very well. And he says, or she, says, "Games need to be interactive and everyone's experience may be slightly different. That doesn't necessarily translate to a linear story like a movie or a book."
Yeah, I mean, isn't it the thing that is that, yeah, the film, it's all just cutscenes.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's just, you can't do anything with them, yeah. Can you? Charles, what did you find?
On the technology blog, Jack was looking at the vexed question raised by the New York Times of, does blogging kill more people than video gaming? Because of New York Times reckoning that blogs are the new sweatshops where a growing workforce of home office labourers and entrepreneurs armed with computers and smartphones and white to the hilt are toiling under great physical and emotional stress created by a round-the-clock internet economy that demands a constant stream of news and comment. I mean, in the post itself, Jack was saying, "Oh, it's so tough, so much worse than making cheap rugs or sneakers, subsistence farming, or my previous job in the uranium mines." And someone took him up on this in the comments and said, "Oh, come on, Jack, everyone knows that all uranium miners are dead now." And Jack replied, "Maybe I still have a half-life."
Oh, that
works.
Droll,
it's not just droll. Not just uranium, it's video games too.
Bobby, you've come up with nothing.
I am going to steal your thunder now and steal something that you were going to say.
All right,
because I've got now in the cupboard.
You've got now. Gives you some
it's like
time.
A news quiz, isn't it?
Yeah, it's, I'm not going to lie. I'm just, you know, I didn't do my homework. We didn't get any comments about our April Fools last week. Well, actually, I did see a Twitter message about
it. Did you?
It. Yeah. I don't know if they fell for it or not. I couldn't tell. No, I have these things in my RSS reader, you see. But, you know, it is a lie. Internet Explorer is not going to be the default Mac browser. Mm. Bet that worried you for a minute there, didn't it?
Especially not after what Richard Clayton said.
Oh. No. And then... We got a great email, which I'll pass back to Alex for. But it's basically on the subject of our Facebook group. We've now got 325 members in the group called I Love the Guardian's Tech Weekly Podcast, and we managed to find a bit of juicy gossip about our 200th member and competition winner, Dan Scott.
That's right. Yeah, I know. I couldn't believe it, actually. Yeah. When somebody got in touch and they said, if it wasn't for an Australian lifeguard, Dan would probably be floating somewhere in the Pacific Ocean on his bodyboard right now. after choosing not to read the sign warning about strong currents in the sea.
Is this going to be a regular feature, the Dan Scott
I think
feature?
So. Mm. Who out there knows Dan Scott? No, yeah. Sorry, Dan, you must be a very nice person, but we're now destroying your reputation. But ultimately, I'd just like to point out that was actually from Dan's brother, Ross. He got in touch. But don't smack him just yet, Dan. Ross is now one of our best friends because, and I'll pass this back to Bobby. He says,
if you ever need to financially justify the tech show to any important people at The Guardian, as a result of listening to Tech Weekly and Science Weekly, I now read The Guardian instead of The Times.
Oh, well,
and I'm a little more liberal for doing so.
I wonder if he's got his Jesus sandals
you.
Yet.
I'll take you out on a date, my friend.
Bobby's wearing lovely sandals right now.
And chewing on his sprouts. Anyway, if you've got something to say, please do let us know at blogs.guardian.co.uk/technology/games/digital content. Or you can send us an email at tech@guardian.co.uk. Tech, T-E-C-H, at guardian.co.uk.
I'm Alok Jha, and on the latest Science Weekly podcast, everything you wanted to know about stem cells but didn't have an expert around to ask. We hear from Doug Melton, co-director of the Harvard Stem Cell Institute. Also in the show, a robotic surgeon that can help during an operation by preempting the doctor. Plus,
no, didn't drop your dot all on the proggy map.
Science in regional accents. Don't worry, it'll all become clear. It's all in the latest Science Weekly at guardian.co.uk/audio.
I'd like to officially ask our producer, Scott, what the hell that meant.
You're going to have to listen to Science Weekly.
Oh, man.
I thought he said something about dropping his dongle on the doggy mat.
Actually, I was in that recording of Science Weekly, and I still don't have any idea what that meant.
It's a northernism for don't drop your cigarette ash on the carpet.
Hey.
Oh. All right. Well, thank you very much. We're all more entertained and informed, for sure. At the minute, though, it's almost goodbye time. But before we leave you, Charles, please fill us in on what we can read this Thursday in the tech section.
We have our own survey done by an ethical hacker looking at e-commerce companies in the UK, found that many don't implement security standards for passwords and emails. Google Street View is being sued in the US by a couple called The Borings, really, but is now coming to the UK. The Land Registry has abandoned plans to do e-conveyancing because it realised that a slightly bent solicitor could buy and sell Canary Wharf in a day and then pocket the proceeds and disappear. We have a profile of Lord Errol, who is the only hereditary peer who's been on the sharp end of IT and possibly the most knowledgeable person about IT in the whole of the Commons. We look at Numenta, a Silicon Valley startup which is looking to build an artificial brain. In comment, Andrew Brown looks at Joseph Weizenbaum, who is the guy who wrote the ELIZA psychoanalytic program. Vic Keegan looks at the biggest social network on mobile phones, and Mike Cross on how the government is retreating from e-government.
Of course, you can keep on top of things all week on the site, guardian.co.uk/technology, or on the blogs. Many thanks to our guests, Neil Thompson, Dr. Richard Clayton, and the folks at Social Innovation Camp, and of course, Jemima, Charles, and Bobby. See you next Tuesday.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.